Like Stallman and John Gilmore and others of my generation, one could say I got involved with free software when I was a child because software was freer then. I started working as an APL applications programmer for the Scientific Timesharing Corporation in 1973 when I was 14. I worked as an APL applications designer and implementer for SDSC and for Xerox through the 70s. And in 1979, I went to work for IBM at the Santa Teresa Laboratory, hacking on APL interpreters for IBM. I worked on APL, I worked on APL 2. I wrote a big piece of IBM's first Pascal compiler. The way that we did that work was, after all, by sharing code with people who used the code in the IBM install base. And they helped us to design and implement and improve and hack on stuff. They had the source, and when they sent an 8-par, they sent a patch. So in a way, of course, we lived in a free software environment. Sure, there were nominal rules of ownership, but in 1979, when the Cantu Commission was just finishing thinking this all through, the rules were not well understood or depended upon by pretty much anybody. Was it copyrightable? AT&T and IBM kind of disagreed. How much could you patent? Pretty much nothing. Was it a trade secret? Well, no, it was a product differentiator for expensive hardware. So in a way, the world we grew up in was a world that assumed the freedom to tinker. I worked mostly on interpretive programming languages where the source code and the object code were the same. You had to share the program. And I worked on products which were distributed for the 370 environment where the customer expected to get the source code. And if he had the source code of VM and somebody shipped him source code of MVS in some language called PLS that he didn't have a compiler for, he complained because he expected that he would be able to build the product on site. This was a multi-million dollar machine. Who was going to tell him he couldn't build the product on site? All right. So in that sense, the answer is forever. But forever happened in a way with a hole in the middle. I was working at IBM in 1979, and somebody asked me for an internal use only review of a thing called the Lisa, which was Apple's then experimental attempt to bring Xerox PARC technology into the Steve Jobs world. And the Lisa was a pre-Macintosh kind of computer, and I wrote an internal appreciation about that computer in which I said, this is a catastrophe. This is the end of language in relation to computers. This is the implementation of the caveman interface. You point and you grunt. And if we reduce the interaction between human beings and computers to pointing and grunting, then we miss the role of language in the evolution of human mind and human consciousness. Language is what makes our brains bigger. If we don't use languages to relate to computers, neither their brains nor our brains will grow in the way that they're supposed to grow. That was a losing argument, even within IBM, but certainly in the world overall, as years went by. And I got less enthusiastic about working on programming in that world because I was a programming language guy and languages weren't what was happening. So I went and I got a law degree and a history PhD and I became a legal historian and I did other work. I went and clerked for Weinfeld in New York, I clerked for Thurgood Marshall. I began asking myself, how does one make justice in the world? I got a job teaching at a fine university as a legal historian, and I wrote a doctoral dissertation and did history writing, and I thought about the long-term meaning of information in human society. And I wanted to do programming because I'm a compulsive programmer and because I had a PC at my disposal, which wasn't the $11 million mainframe I used to have, and it wasn't a great computer, but it was good enough for some things. I didn't like DOS very much, but I never used Windows. That was the thing it wasn't good to do with computers. I wasn't going to be shocked into using something that was the very thing I didn't want made worse. I knew what X Windows was. Who would want to use this? The brain, right? So I fooled around with Coherent when the Mark Williams company created a $99 crippled Unix, and I tried it. And I started using it with the GNU tools, but then I used the GNU tools in DOS. I used DJGPP, Daniel Delery's C compiler for porting Unix to DOS to run Emacs in my DOS machine because, like Mr. Stallman, I believed in Emacs deeply. Right? So in that sense, free software was always there, but I was living a largely non-technical life. In 1991, I decided that I saw what I needed to do in order to begin working on freedom in the 21st century. Public key encryption was the first thing that had to be dealt with. We needed it for two reasons: to keep secrets from governments and to have electronic commerce. And so I started looking around for a way to do public key encryption that would break the government's encryption rules. And in July of 1991, I saw a program called Pretty Good Privacy released to a FIDO bulletin board in New York City. And I took the zip files down and I looked at the user's manual and I read the source code because Phil had released it. And I wrote an unsolicited email to the author, Phil Zimmerman, this guy I'd never heard of in Boulder, Colorado. And I said, congratulations, you're going to change the world. You're also going to get in a shitload of trouble. And when it happens, I can help you. Here's who I am. Here's what I've done. Here's what I know. When you get in trouble, call me. And I was 10 days ahead of the nice customs agent and FBI agent who knocked on his door in Boulder and started the mess. So I went to work as a volunteer with a local Boulder criminal defense lawyer and a couple of other people who walked in overtime trying to keep the federal government from indicting Zimmerman for Arms Export Control Act violations. And our goal was to drive this one case as deep as we could into the heart of the control system and blow it up from inside if we possibly could. While I was working on Zimmerman, I got a moment with John Markoff of the Times. And I said in the course of that interview a thing about the right to speak PGP is the right to speak Navajo. And Markoff printed it in the Times, and that got to be a little tagline which ran around in people's email sigs for a couple of months. Stallman saw the coverage of Markoff's coverage in the Times, and he wrote to me. And he said, I've got a little personal legal problem and I need some help. It looks like you might be the guy who could help me. And I wrote back and said, I use Emacs every day. It'll be a long time before you exhaust your entitlement to free legal help from me. And he asked me to do something, and I went and did it for him. And then I realized that he was the listening post for me to figure out where to go next. I had figured out what I wanted to do about encryption, and I could see that we were going to get done. But I didn't understand what to do next to make technological freedom in the 21st century. This was the fall of 1993, and I realized everybody in the world who has technological freedom problems knows one email address, rms@gnu.org. If he sends me everything sent to rms@gnu.org that needs a lawyer, pretty soon I will actually have figured out what it is that needs doing in the world, because he has the best strategic perspective there is. So I sat on his shoulder for a couple of years, doing whatever the work was that he thought was important, and learning what everything in the world was that people were writing to him about. And eventually I said, you need a general counsel. And he said, sure. And I started doing the work. Now, it was still just work I was doing in my spare time. I was still a legal historian. Nobody in the academy had the vaguest idea what the hell this was. And every once in a while, I would tell people free software is going to take over the world. And they would say, yeah, yeah, right, right. Thanks very much. Bye. And that would be that. But I knew where we were going. And more importantly, I understood that Stallman was indeed the tallest possible mountain. And by standing on his shoulders, you could see forever. And Newton and everybody before Newton, all the way back to Bernard of Chartres, is right, right? We are midgets standing on the shoulders of giants, and that's what I was. Stallman was a giant, and I stood on his shoulders, and I saw the terrain. So in that sense, you could say 1993, or you could say 1995. What you could say after that was that I did more as there was more to do, but I couldn't make myself nine orders of magnitude bigger, right? The cosmos inflated very suddenly, and people noticed it was there. And so in an odd way, the answer is I was there before the Big Bang, and time didn't exist. Because most people measure this stuff from some moment later on when it began to happen, whatever it was. And my view is it's just the unrolling of a thing that came from very far long ago. It's a reversal of a local eddy in the current of time. Microsoft made it appear that software was a product for a little while. But knowledge is rarely a product. And the technological information about the terms on which we and the digital brains exist, that's not a product. That's a culture. That's the record of a deposit of human beings and the other in conversation. It's like literature. It can't be a product. So what we are discovering is it's a culture made by communities. And we could have known that in 1965 or 1970. It was hard to see in 1990, but it's easy to see again in 2006. In my judgment, this is, in that historical sense, more about clearing away a temporary confusion than it is about some strange and amazing departure that suddenly occurs.